Monday morning with me, Rob Cowan. I hope you'll be able to join me again, same time next week, 9 o'clock.
Sunday morning with Rob Cowan is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
On BBC 2.
I'm investigating how we flunked the challenge of the relentless rise of China, how we boosted our living standards by borrowing lethal amounts, and why the party's over.
Robert Peston looks at the breakdown of Western capitalism and what the future now holds for the UK's economy.
The economic model that generated the longest period of uninterrupted rapid growth in our history is bust. So how do we build a more robust economic model?
The party's over. Tonight at 7 o'clock on BBC Two.
And now, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Dan Stevens has had great success as Matthew Crawley in Downton Abbey on television recently. He also played the lead role in the BBC's adaptation of Alan Hollinghurst's The Line of Beauty. And on the stage, he's worked with Peter Hall in Hay Fever, Much Ado About Nothing and As You Like It, and with Samuel West directing The Romans in Britain. There have been many radio productions and audiobooks, including War Horse. In fact, I think those books have been rather important to you in a way, haven't they?
They have. I hugely enjoy doing them, and I think a lot of actors see them as something that you do in between jobs, but it's something I grew up loving audiobooks and loving voices and things like that, and it's a fantastic outlet for lots of very silly accents and voices that I don't get an opportunity to do elsewhere.
It's a bit of a cliche, really, but the success of Downton Abbey has rather propelled you in front of the public, hasn't it?
I suppose it has, yes. I mean, it's sort of what every actor dreams of, is that kind of job that can open doors and give you opportunities for things like that. But it has been a rollercoaster couple of years since we started.
It's very ironic, isn't it? Because, as I mentioned, you worked with great directors like Peter Hall and Sam West. And you do all of the work that goes into that. And then you do a television thing and suddenly the world changes. It's sort of ironic.
Yes, it's funny. But there's parts of all those jobs that go into the next. And I consider that work very much my training, my classical background, if you will. You know, I didn't go to drama school. I came straight out of Cambridge and was lucky enough to get into the Peter Hall company, and that was hugely important to me. And yes, I think if you were to go straight into something like Downton, as some of the actors did, you know, it must be quite a shock. I mean, it's been a shock for me. I don't know what it's like for them.
I know you spent quite a lot of your childhood around Brecon in Mid Wales.
Yes, I did. We spent a few years there. My parents taught at Christ College, and it was the most extraordinary place to grow up, and to have the Brecon Beacons as your playground. It was very, very special. I love Wales, I still do.
And I think that the first music actually comes from an experience in that area.
It does. It's actually a piece that I've sung both as a treble in Brecon and then as a bass later at school at Tunbridge. So it's the only piece I've sung twice in sort of two different voices, if you will. And I've always just completely adored it. I mean, it was a very formative experience as an 8-year-old boy going along to the choral society at Christ College. And I was standing there with, you know, lots of sixth form girls, and that was lovely. And all the rugby team were, you know, the bass and the tenors behind. And it was the most fantastic atmosphere. It's very different from being in a choir, I think. But it was a really special experience. And we sang it in Brecon Cathedral, I think back in 1991. That was the first time I sang it. And then got another crack at it as a bass. And it is the most amazing piece to sing as a bass. I think it's far better than singing it as a treble, really. You can, you know, get some cracking.
It's really fascinating to see a piece of music from those two perspectives. I mean, it's like walking around the mountain and looking at it from another side.
Absolutely. And I suppose, I mean, it's not something I've really had the chance to do yet, but in theatre, I imagine there are roles that you can go back and, you know, a classic play, you'll play a more senior role later on and completely reappraise the piece. And so Mozart is definitely sort of, the Requiem has lived with me for a long time, and it's just so much fun to sing. And this particular section I just chose because I just think it's completely beautiful.
It has an extraordinary kind of yearning lilt to it, doesn't it?
It's just so painful almost to hear, but it's a beautiful piece to sing, and I particularly love the words ex favilla. I don't know, I always remember just really wonderful words to get your tongue around, and I loved Latin at school, and I think it's an incredibly important subject, and I was a great linguist at school, really, you know, went on to do French and German and English. Yes, it was sort of quite a good fun way of flexing the Latin and getting up and belting it out in a cathedral or something and really using it and understanding it. And Mozart helped a bit with that. So.
The Lacrimosa from the Requiem in D minor, Kirkel 626 by Mozart, the Hanover Band and Chorus conducted by Roy Goodman. If that wonderful Lindsay Anderson film is slightly behind this next choice, and I think we have to be honest and say you did have a somewhat rebellious streak in you yourself, didn't you?
Possibly, and it may have come from watching this film, I don't know. But when we moved from Wales, I went for a very brief time at a prep school in Kent, and there was an extraordinary teacher there called Mr. Smith, who taught pretty much everything. And when I had the opportunity to get a scholarship to Tunbridge School, which was the next stop, I think it was a bit of a sort of tradition of his to take the boys who were going to Tunbridge and show them this film, because David Sherwin, who wrote it, had been to Tunbridge, hated it back in, I mean, this is back in the 50s, but I mean, he completely loathed it and wrote this really, really sort of poisonous piece about life at a public school. So there were about, I guess, 12 boys aged 13 sat in this room watching this absolutely extraordinary film, If, and a very key part of that film is this piece from the Missa Luber, the Sanctus. And I played it almost incessantly throughout my teenage years. And just the way in which Malcolm McDowell indulges his bizarre rebellious fantasies to the soundtrack of this tune.
He had a wonderfully kind of mad, bulging eye look too, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the most extraordinary performances and just completely captivated me when I first saw it. And I've seen it several times since. And I have to say, Tunbridge was nothing like, my experience was nothing like what is in the film. But there was definitely something of this film in the back of my mind throughout my years there. And this tune was...
You never actually shot one of your teachers,
not quite, no.
Huge raw energy.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's an amazing story as well about the choir that sang that originally, you know, back in the 50s. I think they were discovered by a Belgian priest who was visiting the Congo, and he brought them over to tour Europe, and they were a huge hit. And I think for a while that tune was actually in the charts in the UK, which is a sort of an unthinkable thing these days. But no, I love it. It makes me very excited, that piece.
Les Troubadours de Roi Baudouin were performing the Sanctus from the Missa Luber. The next music is early music. Do you like early music?
I absolutely adore early music. My father's a huge classical music fan and has a, you know, fantastic collection. And this was a record that I pinched from him quite early on and never gave back. And this record has sort of lived with me for many, many years. And I listened to it a lot at university. Would, you know, sort of stay up till 5 or 6 in the morning finishing essays to this. I found it very, very calming, and it focused the mind very much.
It has the kind of coolness, doesn't it, of sort of cathedral architecture.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the music is designed to fit the architecture. And in fact, I was in Westminster Abbey the other day and walking around, and you just realise that these vast structures were designed to be filled with this sort of towering spirals of sound. And this polyphonic music really, really does that. It really fills the space. I used to occasionally sneak into King's College Chapel and Clare to hear the choirs sing some of their early stuff. I didn't go nearly enough, and it's something I regret, but it is a beautiful sound and I love listening to it.
The Kyrie from the Mass for Four Voices by William Byrd. We heard the Oxford Camerata, conducted by Jeremy Summerlee. Has the recent successes you've had led to some interesting projects that you've got coming up or working on?
Yes, well, actually, we've been developing a film which is an adaptation of a novel by Jonathan Smith, who was a teacher at Tunbridge, who directed me in a lot of my plays and who I've done a lot of radio plays with, actually. And we've been looking to turn it into a film for about 5 or 6 years, and it looks like, fingers crossed, it may be happening in January, which is very exciting, down in Cornwall, which won't be warm, but it will be a lot of fun, and that's a very, very beautiful, quite dark love story. I did a very silly film last year, a vampire romantic comedy, which is coming out next year, completely different again, which has Alicia Silverstone and Sigourney Weaver in it, which involves me attacking Sigourney Weaver with a chainsaw. So yes, you know, we're mixing it up quite a lot, which is nice. And you know, I continue to do radio and audio. And but yes, I mean, Downton is fairly all consuming when it's on. Time will tell what comes afterwards, but it's quite exciting.
Are we allowed to talk at all about what's coming next? Because you're at a bit of a pivotal moment, aren't you?
Yes, it didn't end on a high for Matthew Crawley. Yes, there's a Christmas special on Christmas Day, and it gets a bit happier, if I can say that, a little bit. But there's you know, a little bit of resolution for Christmas, just as a gift to the viewers.
What do you think, looking back on it, what do you think of the things, what are the ingredients that have made this Talking of Christmas such a happy cake?
It's such a difficult question, really. I mean, there's a lot of elements that just came together and clicked and sort of took it beyond your regular sort of costume drama, I suppose. I think first and foremost, it's terrific writing. There's some great lines, great storylines. And there are about 20 fantastic characters in it, and they were cast really well, and everybody got their characters, they understood them and owned them very early on. And I suppose the fact that it's not an adaptation of something classic, so we're not sort of bound by Jane Austen or George Eliot's rules, you know, as to where the story must go. Julian Fellowes can literally, you know, pull anything out of the bag, as he often does, and take us in a quite bizarre and exciting direction, which keeps the viewers on their toes and keeps us actors on our toes as well, which makes it fun to play.
Now, you didn't sing in The Bird, Dan Stevens, but I think you did sing in The Foray. And actually, we are getting... I don't know why you have this great predilection for Requiem.
But it's rather morbid, isn't it? I was looking at this list and thinking, gosh, yes, I must come across quite miserable. I think also, you know, when I have listened to classical music in my life, it's generally been very late at night. And so, you know, I say the louder, jumpier stuff for sort of during the day, and then at the end of the evening, you turn to something quieter, more reflective. And so that's where a lot of these choices come from, I suppose. You know, I love reading a great tragedy as much as I like a comic story, and there's plenty of comic classical music I could have played, but, you know, for some reason, the sadder stuff got me today. So.
Well, this is a wonderful apotheosis to the Requiem Mass, isn't it, this...
It's absolutely stunning, and again, it, you know, goes back to my days in choral society. I suppose I was never a good enough or skillful enough singer to be in the actual choir, where you got to sing beautiful things like The Bird. But you know, once a year, you could get up and belt out a bit of Mozart or Foray, and especially as a bass, you have quite a lot of fun in the bass section. It's quite a sort of naughty part of the choir, and. Certainly when I was at Tunbridge, it was quite a nice way of meeting girls, because the altos and sopranos would be shipped in from local schools, and that led to a bit of fun as well. But I have to say, as soon as this section came in Foray's Requiem, for some reason it was completely sort of transcendental, and suddenly, you know, you stopped looking at the girls from what they were, and suddenly just started listening to what they were singing and singing along with it, and it just completely sort of snapped me out of my
Your mind went to higher things.
And it really did. It's the most sublime piece, and yeah, I'm very happy to have it on the list.
So will your wife be.
Thank you.
I must say, from a bass point of view, and I have the same kind of vantage as you do, I think the Liber Arme is a wonderful moment to sing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a belter. Yeah.
We heard In Paradisum from the Fauré Requiem, definitely not belted out there, by Maîtrise de Paris et Accentus and the Orchestre National de France, conducted by Laurence Equibet. You must be rather interested, somebody who really loves music, Dan Stevens, and is a man of the theatre, as it were, when they come together and you get music in film and theatre.
Yes, I experienced it firsthand, I suppose, a couple of years ago when I performed in Every Good Boy Deserves Favour at the National.
Oh, the Previn
Previn and Stoppard piece, yeah. I only got the part because I told them that I could play the violin, which I could about 15 years ago. So I very quickly had to brush up a few skills and play a brief solo, in fact, at the Olivier Theatre. But yeah, so that literally was a fusion of orchestra and actors and some dancers in that production as well. And that was a magical experience. And getting to meet Previn was... I'm just remembering the rehearsal that he came into to see me play my solo. And I was playing this slightly bonkers doctor who was more obsessed with playing the violin than medicine, really. And the entire orchestra were very, very nervous when... You know, Andre turned up and he came in with his stick and sat down at the front, and the conductor was shaking more than anybody I've ever seen, I think, second only to me. And I got up, played this rather bizarre solo, and there was this long, long silence, and everybody turned to Previn to see what he thought and whether it was appropriate to the character. And he just sort of looked up and he said, "Oh, it was good. Possibly too good." I rushed home and I told my wife, I said, "You'll never guess what Andre Previn said about me. Good, possibly too good." And she had a T-shirt and a mug made up with that. Previn on Stevens, good, possibly too good, for my opening night present. So I was, very, very delighted by those words.
Of course, some composers have made soundtracks which they've then turned into concert pieces. So that's true, really, I think, of this piece too, Philip Glass.
Yes, well, eventually he adapted it and took it on tour. And in fact, I was lucky enough to see the Philip Glass Ensemble play Coenus Catsey in its entirety with the film playing at the Barbican about 7 or 8 years ago, I think. But I was introduced to the film before I saw it played live. I was at university and a great friend just sort of sat me down, and it was really one of those films that people really pass on with that look in their eye, like, you have to see this. And he was absolutely right. I mean, it's just the most mind-blowing piece of cinema. And it was directed by an extraordinary man called Godfrey Reggio, who I think in his sort of mid-late teens decided to go and train for the Congregation of the Christian Brothers, which is very similar to sort of Trappist. He was essentially silent for about 14 years. And he gave up his training and immediately went and made this extraordinary series of films. They are silent, I suppose. Well, they have music, but there is no dialogue in them. They are wordless films. And I got really obsessed with them for a while and was really interested in his theory of this. And he was talking about it's not for a lack of love of language that these films have no words in them, but that he felt that our language had sort of reached this state of vast humiliation, which I loved the phrase. It's the most extraordinary sort of tone poem in a way. And Glass's soundtrack is very much hand in hand. They were great friends, he and Reggio, and the music is just sort of mind-blowing, really.
Koyaanisqatsi. We actually heard the voice of Koyaanisqatsi there, performed by Albert de Ruyter. Michael Riesman played the organ, in fact, conducted the orchestra too on that recording. The next piece, Dan Stephen, actually, I think involves a friend of yours, and you were doing music for a production, between you, I mean.
Yes, this is a piece played by John Spires and John Bowden, and it's a folk tune. And John was invited down to Cambridge when we were doing a production of Macbeth. It was directed by a young director called Ben Naylor. And John is one of those extraordinary musicians who can pick up any instrument and within about 8 minutes will be sort of grade 8 standard. And, you know, these can be some of the most obscure instruments, and he has a sort of bizarre collection of them. And, you know, of an evening we would go over to Ben's rooms and John would get out his fiddle and play covers of Britney Spears tunes in folk style. He'd play Tom Waits songs. And he also played this tune, which every time he played it reduced the entire room to tears. It's just one of the most tragic cautionary ballads, but I just completely fell in love with it. And we actually got John to play at our wedding. It's not a very appropriate tune to play at a wedding, so he played something else. But but it is, it's a wonderful cautionary tale about seizing the moment and not waiting too long to pop the question to that special lady. It's rather beautiful.
It was on one Monday morning, and oh, and it was soon, I bought my pretty Betty a pair of new shoes, a pair of new shoes and slippers, oh, so. But I lost my pretty Betty by courting too slow. I lost my pretty Betty by courting too slow. I bought my pretty Betty a garland of green, ribbons that you wear, so fair to be seen, rings for her fingers, so made of glittering gold. I lost my pretty Betty by North Indian gold. I lost my pretty Betty by not being on one Tuesday evening, oh, and it was late. I failed what I've kissed her, I was too straight. I was thinking how to gain her consent to be true. But I lost my pretty Betty by courting too slow. I lost my pretty Betty by courting too slow. For in there come a sailor, all in his tarry trousers. He went into the chamber where my true love was. He flattered her song. He fell one day by my am I courting too slow? So come on, you bold fellows, and pray take my advice. And when you go a-courting, now don't you be too nice. But you kiss all them pretty girls, and you let them fall too low. That you don't mean use them by courting too slow. That you don't mean to lose them by courting too slow.
You got to watch out for those sailors.
We heard John Bowden and John Spires with Peter Bellamy's Courting Too Slow. Well, we are getting into quite sad waters, actually.
I have to say,
because the next piece has an Ash Wednesday text, so it's pretty penitential. But there's an interesting story about it. It's a very popular piece, the Allegri Miserere, Dan.
Yes, I mean, it is my pop choice, I suppose, in a way. I mean, it's, you know, it's early music classic. I have no particular sort of personal connection to it. I've never sung it. I did once hear it sung in King's College Chapel, which was sublime. But it was a piece, a bit like Quae Nescatia, in fact, that Ben Naylor, the director of the production of Macbeth at Cambridge, sat me down and said, you've got to listen to this. And it is just sort of, it's a towering work. And I love the story behind this. I can't remember exactly what happened, but it was banned from being played outside the Sistine Chapel, was that right?
Yes, well, the thing is, actually, you're in very good company in terms of liking it, because the church authorities knew they were onto a sort of winner with it, and so they wouldn't let copies go outside.
That's right.
However, they didn't allow for a certain young Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart,
uh-huh,
who memorised it completely by ear and wrote it all down from memory, and so took it outside that way. That's at least...
That's so the legend goes, that's
Peter
right,
Phillips
yes.
has recalled it. And he, in fact, is directing the Talis Scholars here in this performance, and they've been very careful, I think, to put the groups of singers at some distance from each other so that you get the sort of suspensions that gives it that slightly twisting the knife moment.
Yes.
And of course, it's got a very famous high C for the treble.
Yes, I mean, that's the moment. It just completely pierces your soul. It's just the most sublime piece of music.
Thank you.
It's quite incredible, isn't it? It's, I love the stories that surround it. I mean, there's that story about Mozart, but there's also, again, I can't remember the details, but some cardinal in the Vatican decided that that high C was either too sacrilegious or too sacred for anybody else to hear, so it was sort of locked away, and it just, you know, amazing myths around it.
Yes, absolutely. The Miserere of Allegri, performed there by the Tallis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips. Let's talk just for a moment about the Alan Hollinghurst, The Line of Beauty, because that was such an extraordinary book, and not one that one would necessarily immediately have thought would translate without quite a lot of work onto the screen, although the story, of course, is filmic. But his writing is so descriptive, isn't it?
It is intensely descriptive, but that said, it was possibly the best resource I've ever had as an actor when putting something on the screen. You know, I must have read that book 4 or 5 times, maybe 6 times, and I would go back to certain passages every night because, you know, he has this laser-like precision with his characters and with particularly what Nick sees and how he sees the world. And I became completely absorbed by the book. It was a real privilege to work on it, and you know, it's to this day one of the things I'm proudest of, I think.
You had the next music, Dan Stevens, at your wedding.
Yes, it sort of came about while we were preparing for the wedding. I was, as I say, performing at the National, playing my violin as well as I could, in and amongst a rather wonderful orchestra called the South Bank Symphonia, which is a sort of graduate orchestra. And they got so involved and stuck into what was asked of them with this mad production. And I was sat in and amongst the, I think, I can't remember if I was first or second violin. I think I was probably second. Sat alongside a lovely guy called Joe Ichinose, who has a great string quartet. And so he said, well, I'll play at your wedding. And so we looked through, you know, various pieces. We didn't, you know, wanted something a little bit unconventional, not, you know, massively. But he suggested this piece, actually. And I love the idea of it being a concerto for two violins. I just think, you know, and when you hear this largo, it's almost like a spiral of DNA or something, two things very much intertwining and becoming one. So it seemed very appropriate, and it's a very beautiful piece, and I always think of my wife when I hear it.
Thank you.
It should be said it didn't take her 6 minutes to walk up the aisle, but but we found that recording and liked the pace of the Daniel Hope, but it's a better speed to walk up an aisle to.
The Largo Ma Non Tanto, in other words, not too much, by Bach, from the Concerto for Two Violins in D Minor, BWV 1043, played there by Daniel Hope and Marijke Blankenstein with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe.
You're quite keen on jazz, which I think you feel says something about you.
Yes, well, it's something my wife and I share. She was a jazz singer for many years, and this is just a song that we both adore. It says a fair bit about me and perhaps why I like classical music, because I am a bit old-fashioned in some ways. And I'm very aware that Chet Baker is not perhaps the greatest jazz vocalist that ever lived, but I just love this song. I love this version of it.
I'm old-fashioned. I love the moonlight. I love the old-fashioned things. The sound of rain upon my window pane. The starry song that April sings. This year's fancies are passing fancies, but sighing sighs. Holding hands, these my heart understands. I'm old-fashioned, but I don't mind it. That's how I want to be. As long as you agree to stay old-fashioned with me. Year's fancies are passing fancies, but sighing sighs, holding hands, please my heart. But I don't mind it. That's how I want to be. As stay old-fashioned with me.
Fantastic piano playing too. From
Isn't
Kenny
it a wonderful
Drew.
Solo? Yeah, I absolutely love it. Yeah.
Words by Johnny Mercer, music by Jerome Kern. I'm Old Fashioned. We heard Chet Baker singing, Kenny Drew playing the piano, George Morrow the bass, and Philly Joe Jones the drums.
The thing about a lot of these tunes is that, you know, they last through the ages, and as Chet sings, you know, a lot of music is just sort of passing fancy. But these, I think, they really stand the test of time.
Well, Dan Stevens, thank you very much for sharing these piece of music with us, and we all look forward to seeing what happens to you at Christmas in Downton Abbey.
Thank you very much.
Dan Stevens was talking to Michael Barclay. There's no edition of Private Passions next week, but in 2 weeks' time, which is, of course, Christmas Day, Michael's guest will be the composer, producer and theatrical entrepreneur Andrew Lloyd Webber. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of this week's programme was Chris Marshall. Now, just before the news, a word from Alad Jones.
For the choir this weekend on Radio 3, a city which famously hosted the first ever performance of none other than Handel's Messiah, with choristers from Christ Church Cathedral. It's a hop over the Irish Sea to Dublin on something of a choral pilgrimage in search of some of the city's many choral activities. There'll also be the opportunity to hear a rather unusual work for choir and recorder, setting words by Hans Christian Andersen. So do join me, Alad Jones, and my guests this afternoon at 5 o'clock. On BBC Radio 3.
Well, hello from me, John Shea. Welcome to this Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3. The early music show is in a couple of minutes, but now at 1 o'clock, the latest BBC News, read by David Cornett.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has said he's bitterly disappointed at the outcome of the Brussels summit. Britain has become the only country in the European Union to oppose a new treaty which is aimed at tackling the Eurozone debt crisis. But the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, insists that the UK will not become marginalised as a result of David Cameron's decision not to sign up to the deal. Hundreds of soldiers who've defected from the Syrian army are reportedly fighting government troops in the south of the country. It's described as one of the biggest armed confrontations since the start of the uprising against President Bashar al-Assad's rule. A new deal has been reached on climate change at the United Nations conference in South Africa. Delegates agreed an accord which compels the world's biggest polluters to take action on global warming by 2020. In a report out tomorrow, the city watchdog will be highly critical of its own role in the collapse of the Royal Bank of Scotland. The Financial Services Authority will say supervision was deficient in many areas. RBS needed a bailout of £45 billion from taxpayers. The former leader of Panama, Manuel Noriega, is being flown back there from France after he was declared fit to be extradited. He's facing a 20-year prison sentence for murdering political opponents. Police are to begin testing a laser gun which fires a blinding wall of light capable of stopping rioters. The Home Office says the effectiveness of traditional methods of crowd control, such as CS gas and tasers, are limited because of their short range. The first images have been revealed of the royal barge, which will carry the Queen along the Thames during her Diamond Jubilee celebrations in June. The 200-foot cruiser will be red and gold, with an interior described as sumptuous. And the weather, rain in northern England and Wales will become heavier as it moves eastwards. There'll be showers elsewhere, with snow in the Scottish Highlands. Temperatures this afternoon will reach 9 Celsius in Dover and 7 in Cardiff, but only 3 degrees in Perth. BBC News and weather at 1:03.
From David Cornett. Our Sunday concert in an hour's time features Beethoven's string quartets played by the Belcher Quartet. That's at 2 o'clock. But now on Radio 3, it's time for the second of this weekend's editions of the Early Music Show, introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
One evening in the late 1760s, the great poet Pietro Metastasio set quill pen to paper. It wasn't another libretto or some elaborate verses he was engaged in, though, but a letter to his friend Carlo Maria Broschi, the man you and I may know better as the celebrated castrato singer Farinelli. The missive concerned their mutual colleague, the composer Nicola Porpora. "I could not resist the pity that our poor friend aroused in me yesterday," wrote Metastasio in the flickering candlelight of his study. "It is indeed a tearful thing to see a man of such merit in his profession being reduced to a real lack of daily bread. He is a man of distinction, he is a friend, he is old. We need not do much to avoid his death. Every impulse obliges us to succour him. Do so if you can. Your benefit will fall upon a person known all over Europe." It's clear that their friend Porpora was in a desperate state. But how did a man who'd been so successful, one of Europe's best-loved composers, come to be reduced to such poverty? Nicola Porpora had been unquestionably one of the most famous musicians of his day. Composer, singing teacher and theatrical powerhouse, he was right in the heart of the action, and is now viewed as an important link between Handel, who was his great adversary, and Haydn, who was one of his pupils. Born in Naples in 1686, the year after Handel, at just 10 years old, he was enrolled at one of the city's four music conservatories. His father, a bookseller, struggled to afford the tuition fees, but they were waived after just 3 years when Porpora earned his keep as a student teacher. At this time, the great operatic genius in Naples was Alessandro Scarlatti, who more or less monopolised the theatres. Nevertheless, with the support of two influential patrons, Porpora began to carve out a niche as an opera composer himself. And when Scarlatti left the city, Porpora was his natural successor. He was soon the most sought-after opera composer in town. The public adored him and he collaborated with some of the best in the business, including the young Metastasio, who wrote his first two librettos. And the starring role in one of Porpora's first operas went to a young singer who was just starting out, his most talented pupil, the 16-year-old Carlo Broschi. Thus began the career of one of the greatest castrato singers of all time, the one and only Farinelli.
Il gioco, il riso.